ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
ABC Cricket Podcast time. My name's Corbin Middlemass, and there's no Ed Cowan today. We have a very special guest and a more than suitable replacement to chop up everything going on in Australian cricket. He's the man in charge, the chief executive of Cricket Australia, Todd Greenberg, joins me. Todd, appreciate your time.
My pleasure, Corb. Thanks for having me on.
Is there much going on at the moment in Australian cricket? Have you been busy?
Well, I mean, it's the middle of footy season, but feels like talkability for cricket's on the rise. I remember when I first joined cricket, people were saying to me, there needs to be more talkability is the word they use. So we've delivered on that, if nothing else, that's for sure.
There's no doubt about that. We've got so many things that we'd love to pick up and chat about with you, obviously, yeah, all centred around the privatisation stuff. Ben Horne's piece in the weekend paper. I might just start there, given it's the most recent and most current. So he wrote about the fact that there's five holdouts when it comes to Cricket Australia contracts at the moment over essentially pay disputes, and 12 BBL stars that were part of a WhatsApp group that are also unhappy about the finances in the game. Now, the premise of the piece was talking about the fact that they were disgruntled about privatisation and the lack of money that's going to come into the game and the money that went to overseas players as opposed to the local guys. But no name, no pack drill. And this process the whole way through feels like whatever side of the fence you're on, there's been sort of lots of scaremongering, lots of ambit claims. Is that your understanding? Do you know who the players are? Are these players out there? Who are they? What can you tell us about in relation to that piece?
Well, I don't know much other than what you've read as well. So it caught me a bit by surprise over the weekend. But, I mean, as you'd appreciate more than most, we certainly won't comment on player contracts or negotiations. I mean, there's always, as you would appreciate, back and forth with players, maybe more so with their agents more than players directly in the modern game. But, I mean, what's clear to me, whether there's names apportioned to it or not, is that players are being presented with lucrative alternative offers right now, and we're not going to sit on our hands or try to kick some of these decisions down the road. Those challenges are real. We're trying to find a model in Australian cricket that we think pays the players fairly on the revenue that we generate, but also protects the broader sport as well. And that's a fine balancing act.
So it is at odds, particularly the BBL stuff, in relation to what the ACA's saying publicly. So the ACA have essentially come out and said, hey, we're not anti-privatisation, but we're not absolutely for it either. We're not for privatisation at any cost. It has to be the right deal. We have to sit down and obviously work that out with Cricket Australia at the appropriate time. Is it unusual that you've got a number of star players going against their union, essentially, which obviously in the not-too-distant past, Todd, you were in charge of as the CEO of the ACA?
Yeah, it's a unique time in Australian cricket's history, I do think that, you know, do we have a model that's fit for purpose? And what I mean by that is we've had a model that's generated the primary amount of its revenue through bilateral cricket, you know, country versus country cricket. And our modern-day players now generate enormous amounts of income from other parts of the world in other leagues outside of that bilateral arrangement. And I suppose an open question for us, the ACA, and the broader cricket ecosystem is our model fit for purpose? Will it serve us in the next decade as it's done in the previous? And that's a hard question to answer as we sit here today, but part of a job like mine is collating the data and the inputs, talking to people, being an active listener, but then ultimately making some recommendations for the system to consider.
Can I just talk to you about the premise of the BCG report? So my understanding was the premise of the report was essentially to reset the BBL. Is that correct?
Yeah, first blush at the BCG work was, are we maximising the BBL in its current format? What would need to be true in order to take the BBL to the next level? That was sort of phase one of that piece of work, yes.
And it feels like the conversation, though, has evolved somewhat from, you know, how do we best reset the BBL and make that the best competition that it can be, to all of a sudden the conversation's kind of moved over here a little bit, where it's now all of a sudden this is for the future finances of the game and for Australian cricket more broadly. It's not just about the BBL. It felt like at least a lot of the conversation from New South Wales and Queensland's point of view is centred around, well, are there other ways we can go about resetting the BBL? And now it feels like, you know, that the conversation, at least, you know, from some of the reporting around it, has been very much, this is actually for the life of Australian cricket, that without this, essentially, that the game's not going to be able to function.
Yeah, I think that's fair and accurate that the initial recommendations of the BCG review went further And certainly went further because it was at the same point that I joined in this role at CA, and I had the opportunity to get right under the hood of the game's economic model and what the future forecasting looks like. And I don't think you have to be Einstein to have a look at the way that our game's economic model works. We've got long-term future broadcast, domestic broadcast locked in till 2031. And the open question on all of us is, what does the future look like beyond that, in a world where we're a relatively small economy sitting in a small island here of, you know, less than 30 million people competing on a global stage? Can we continue to sustain ourselves like we have done? And we've done a very good job of this over a long period of time. Is our model fit for purpose into the next decade or two? And so that's sort of the advent, if you like, of moving from just considering what an initial injection of capital into the Big Bash has been to a broader consideration of the future of Australian cricket.
Why was that report not made public?
Well, I think to be fair, there's some very sensitive commercial forecasts. The documentation talks a lot to the value currently of our broadcasting revenue and a lot of our commercial revenues. And then it obviously looks at what the forecasting would look like. So, you know, there was some commercial in confidence information. It's in every data room for every state. So every state has had access to that. The leadership of every one of our members has had deep analysis and an opportunity to look at it. But providing it more broadly, I think, was a step too far. In saying that, though, it is incumbent on us as the governing body at some point to articulate some of the recommendations as part of this project. And I think that time is coming shortly.
What does that look like?
What's that, the recommendations?
In being able to, I guess, sell that more broadly.
Well, I think on reflection, you know, we probably could be talking a little bit more about the benefits of what we think private capital brings to cricket as opposed to some of the, maybe I'd call it slight hysteria about what that would or would not look like. You know, I've heard some of the commentary and the narrative that it's taking over cricket and all these sorts of things. I mean, at its most principal level, this is an injection of capital into BBL clubs, not into the league, not into Cricket Australia. The concept is it would create additional value in each of those clubs, bring another level of capability and expertise, whether that is in a cricket sense or it's in a business and commercial sense. And ultimately, the concept of bringing private investment in is at the behest and at the decision of each of the states. They choose who they think would be a suitable partner, who might be value accretive for their business. And every single state, I think, will have a very different view of what that looks like. Some states are very, very interested in a certain partner, and some states aren't interested in partners at this point in time. And I'm a realist. I understand the model which we work in, Corb. It's a federated model of member states, and creating unison and unanimity amongst that group is damn difficult, as is evidenced by the last couple of months.
Does that mean that you need to review the governance structure top down as to how we best do it? I mean, chatting with Ed last week on this podcast, you know, he spoke about, you know, maybe we should have a state board member on the Cricket Australia board. And immediately I thought, well, how's that going to work? Like, we're never going to be able to get a deal done. And I guess the counter argument would be, well, you can't get a deal done anyway, really, without the agreement of all the states. So maybe we're no worse off. Does it need a different approach, all of cricket, not just Cricket Australia, but cricket in Australia, with the, you know, your seven major stakeholders, which are obviously the six states and the players?
Yeah, I think, the governance conversation's probably for another day, probably a longer podcast. But, yeah, we've got our own unique challenges in the way the game's governed. In saying that, though, that's the hand we're dealt, so we have to do the best we can. It's like trying to land a very big jumbo jet on a very skinny runway. So, you know, but that's incumbent on us. I'm not using that as any level of excuse or anything other than that's the demands of the job. So we have to listen carefully. I'm looking for a mandate from our members on what the next step is. And clearly I've got some members in our states who are very, very interested and keen to progress. And I've got some others who have some reservations. And I'm a realist. Probably wasn't hard to figure out that might be the end point, but that's where we find ourselves, and we're trying to find a path forward that will appease and also is the right decision for the future of Australian cricket. That's not an easy balance to find.
Would you progress with a hybrid model?
Yeah, I think we would, and that's something we're actively looking at the moment. But we'd have to be satisfied on a couple of fronts. First and foremost, we'd have to be satisfied that our members, you know, that the effectively the six states would be happy to participate in some level of hybrid model. And I get a sense that there's an open willingness to explore that in my conversations over the last few weeks. It effectively, the sovereignty of some states who'd like to proceed and some of those who don't want to proceed. So finding a hybrid model that impacts everybody, but also have to make sure that we'd satisfy ourselves that we could operate a league in a hybrid model into the future and that we could still generate the type of returns for the investment if we went with some and we held back with others. So those are open questions that we're doing some deep work on as we speak.
What were the biggest concerns of the no voters as such? What were the, biggest concerns that you guys got?
Look, I think Corb, the best way to describe it is there's an active engagement from every single person in Australian cricket that we need to reinvest in both the Big Bash and the game. So that's a tick. So I've won there that everyone's in fierce unanimous agreement. So that's a good starting position. The reality is we have different views on how we get there. And so the states who aren't supportive at this stage, who I've been in very good dialogue with the leadership of both those states. We've maintained good relationships. No one's thrown their toys out of the cot. I don't think, you know, that the tone, the discourse has been healthy. And to be frank, I've quite enjoyed that because debating the merits of a project, I think, are exactly what is healthy for a sport like ours. So I've got nothing but respect and support for those who've got alternate views. And I've continued and will continue to listen carefully. But, you know, ultimately their view is that we want to protect the value in the game by not taking private capital and do some of this work ourselves. And then ultimately what we will do in the future is extract the maximum amount of value without sharing it with a partner. The alternate view on that is, well, if we are a little uncertain about the future, is there an opportunity to take private capital now and use that capital up front in order to protect the game's interests? Those are opposing views, but equally, they both have merit. And I don't have a crystal ball of what the next decade or two might look like, nor do you, nor does anyone really in Australian cricket. But what I can do is take all the inputs, do the research, assess the data, be, as I said before, be an active listener, and ultimately make a set of recommendations. And whether we're right or wrong, I think history is the ultimate judge of that.
Was there a better order, at least, how to get here? Like, there's so many things that obviously need to be worked through, whether it's, you know, that the payment plan as it is at the moment, that the MOU obviously needs to be, you know, torn up and redrawn. You know, as I said about, you know, whether you change governance, you know, whether you allow your players to actually play in the BBL. I mean, at the moment, we don't even have a setup that allows our best players to play, let alone best players from around the world because of the clash with obviously the test matches. And yet it feels like we're putting selling the teams first before we've worried about any of those things that are actually inside cricket's control as it currently sits at the moment. Is, should you have ticked all those boxes before you went to market?
Look, I mean, there's a number of different ways you could have structured this, but I do think that, in essence, it must start with the support of the members. It must start with the support of the states and those who are currently in control of the licenses of the clubs. You know, those active conversations have talked a lot about the things you've just raised, the schedule. Do we have the right schedule? What would that look like in the future? You know, alongside of that, we've been in active conversations with the ACA and the players. So I don't think it's a linear journey. It never was going to be. But I think we're pretty close, and I'm pretty proud of the work that we've done over the best part of 12 to 18 months, the quality of the work, the level of detail that sits inside the data room that's available to the states, I think is first class and answers a lot of questions when you're prepared to do the work to get underneath the skin of the project. But we still have some work to do in order to find a path forward.
There's been a lot of talk about, you know, whether you go to the highest bidder or whether you get the right partner for the game. And I think you're going to sit here and say, look, it's about the right partner and everything else. But what protections can you put in place under a private ownership model where, you know, clearly they own the players, they own the asset, to be able to say, hey, if we need them for national duties, we need them for this, we need them for that, basically that you still have the key asset, which is obviously the labour, at critical times that obviously Australian cricket needs it.
Yeah, I think this is a really important point, Corbin, in relation to where is the investment coming in. It's not coming in at the league level. The league will continue to be run and operated by the governing body as you'd expect. That's the league that sets the rules, the governance, the schedule, the salary cap, those sorts of things. What we're talking about is investors coming in to individual clubs and franchises, looking to make them better. And, you know, I mean, who wouldn't want an investor maybe that's not related to cricket but could bring in a commercial lens, a fan-focused lens, data, insights, AI, these sorts of people who are looking to invest in sports rights all over the world. You know, this might feel slightly new in our country, bringing private capital into sports, but certainly not new globally. And I said this last week and I'd stand by it, and I think a lot of people in cricket would say it as well, that the concept of bringing private capital into cricket is inevitable at some point. The question will remain about when that time actually happens. Mm. And will it happen in your or my lifetime? Will it happen in a short period of time, or will it happen later on? My view is that it will happen. What we have to make sure is, to answer the question you started with, is the levels of controls are in place. And you're not just taking the biggest check, you're looking for the right partner. And I think all the states are actively involved in that level of consideration right now.
I get the feeling that you feel like the global threat of not doing it now is basically now's the time, that we're at breaking point. If we don't do it right now, we're going to be in trouble, even if it's 2 years, 3 years down the track. Is that fair?
Well, I've heard lots of people say, why don't we just sit still for a couple of years and watch what happens? You know, my view is that that's not the greatest strategy in the world when the global cricket landscape is moving, and it's moving at speed. The open question remains, and it's a question for you, for me, for many of us to answer, is our model fit for purpose in the next decade? Can we continue to attract and retain the best players playing both for Australian cricket in bilateral cricket, and can we retain them there? Can we retain them and attract them to the BBL in a market where we're up against private capital all over the world in T20 leagues? Now, I think we've done a brilliant job in the BBL. In fact, I think we're punching well above our weight considering where we are and what we have. My open question is, can we continue to do that if we don't make decisions now that will impact the next media rights deal? So my landscape is very much on what does 2030 beyond look like, and how are we positioning ourselves today for that period of time when we go to market and when we have our commercial offerings up for availability. And the decisions we make today will impact that in the future. If we hang around and wait 2 and 3 and 4 years, I think we've missed the boat. Mm-hmm. And other people will suggest that if we hold on, we may extract broader value back there. I've got a view that the time is now, but that's a personal view. It's certainly the view of the CA board, and it's a view of 3 of the 6 members. So, but we're not there yet. It creates, we need a bit more in order to take the next step.
Yeah, it feels almost like a religious view, though, that it's like we believe that this is the case, but we haven't actually really heard from anyone as to why or how. There's no sort of scientific data to suggest that, you know, now is absolutely the time, and if we don't, we're going to miss the boat. Is that an important thing to be able to sell to the general public, to say, hey, these are the reasons as to why we feel this way?
Well, 2 points on that. One is, there is a lot of data, and there is an enormous amount of data that sits in the availability of the project, which the states are looking at deeply. And I know they've all looked at them deeply about what future forecasting of both revenues, salary caps are competing with the rest of the parts of the world. But when you talk about the Australian public, and I've been talking to a lot of fans over summer, the primary objective, I think, for Australian cricket fans is twofold. One is they want their very best players ensuring they play for the baggy green and representing their country. And two, when they watch the Big Bash, they want to see the best players playing in the Big Bash. And if we can achieve both of those objectives, I'm unsure whether Australian cricket fans have much concern outside of that. Now, of course, there will be measures and controls in place with who comes in, but they're the primary objectives that Australian cricket fans want.
And you feel like there's no other way to achieve these measures? Like, as you said, I feel like everyone's got the same premise. Everyone feels like the guys in the BBL should be paid more, that's behind market forces. I think the hub of the argument is, are there better ways to achieve that that doesn't involve selling an asset that once you've sold it, that's it? You can't sell it again, essentially. You don't feel like, you know, running the business more efficiently at Cricket Australia or across cricket across the board, you know, changing the payment or the MOU with the players to basically, you know, maybe distribute the funds differently, that's more in keeping with global forces. Is that not an answer that involves, you know, putting this on the back burner for the time being?
They're definitely options. So let's go through them one by one. The first one, definitely running the business more efficiently. That's something that we're doing, and we'll wake up every day trying to do, trying to grow revenues, and look at our cost base and create a more efficient CA. And I should say, also a more efficient Australian cricket system. So where there's any level of duplication, where there's any level of investment that we don't need, where we can pull that back and use it in other areas and be more nimble. So that was already in place. I do think there is merit in the conversation about, can we generate the revenue ourselves to invest? But there's also a conversation that says, is there alternate ways to do both? I don't think they're mutually exclusive. We should be running the business as hard as we can, generating as much revenue as possible and creating efficiencies. But there does feel like an opportunity. And ultimately, this project's next step is only to test that valuation, to test that market, to test that market to tell us if the hypothesis is actually correct or not. So I genuinely don't know what our valuations will be, but that's the next step of the process. The next step of the process is, if we're open for business, what does that look like? And if you don't attract the right numbers, then clearly you don't proceed to the next level. But there are some people who are very interested to see what the market would generate and would value at this particular moment in time.
There's been a lot of leaning on the SA20 and the 100. The 100, it feels like there's such a small sample size, we really don't know yet. There's buyer's remorse, whatever it looks like. I mean, clearly, I think it hit the people of Manchester hard when all of a sudden their logo changed, everything else that comes along with obviously private ownership. But the SA20 is a fascinating case where the TV money hasn't, or the TV viewership hasn't been there in the same ways that they had hoped. And as a result, the revenue, there's talk about, you know, the TV partner looking to try and get themselves out of that particular deal as it sits at the moment. What does your study show you when you look at those leagues around the world that have been referenced here? Does it paint a pretty picture for a privatised competition?
Well, it paints an interesting picture in that can all of these leagues survive and can they all thrive? I have a view, and we've demonstrated this through our project, that I think what the future looks like is global T20 leagues will have, and I use this term loosely, you know, a concept of a grand slam, where there'll be three or four major T20 global leagues participating around the world. And clearly the IPL has already found its niche. I think the 100's anchored itself into a slot. And unashamedly, we want to ensure that the BBL sits in that apex and also owns and controls a period and a window of time, which we currently call some part of December and the primary part of January. And we do not want to lose our primacy is a tier one global league. But if we can't pay the players the right amount and we can't generate salary caps that can compete, then the fear is that window will be provided somewhere else. And that's an open question on us. You know, at the moment, as I said before, I think we're doing really well. The advent on top of that is, what happens if you're in those key leagues? Do the winners then play each other in some form of Champions League? And are there other incremental revenues available for those leagues and those teams and those owners? We unashamedly in Australian cricket want to make sure we've got a seat at the top table.
Have you been tipped off that's happening, that this will go ahead as some kind of a grand slam, you know, Champions League at the end of it and everything else, that if the league's not in order, it'll miss the boat?
Well, you can imagine that in a seat like MineCorp, we're privy to lots of conversations with owners of other leagues. We spend an inordinate amount of time, Mike Baird and I, overseas at ICC meetings, and those conversations are fruitful and they're interesting, and they're moving really quickly. And as I said to you, we're a small country competing on a global stage. We want to make sure that the primacy of Australian cricket, which has been so strong for so long, is not next 10 years will be as strong as the last. I feel like change is on the horizon. We've got to make sure that we have an ability to influence that level of change.
What about our own players getting the best guys to play in the competition? So Pat Cummins has, you know, reportedly just restructured his deal. There's big bucks attached to it. Does it involve a component of him playing in the BBL?
Yeah, ultimately what we want is our best players playing in the BBL first and foremost. And as you've said before, at the moment we straddle the summer with some test matches. Is there a slightly alternative way we can look at that in the short term? And then ultimately when the next TV rights comes up, will that consistently stay in its same slot? I think that ultimately is determined by the value that you create there. But the short answer is, yeah, we want our best players playing both for their country in bilateral cricket, but we want them playing in the Big Bash. We unashamedly want our best players playing in the Big Bash. And, you know, if you look around at every sport, in every league, in all over the globe, there's one thing they all have in common. The EPL, the NFL, even here, the NRL and the AFL, they have one thing in common. The best players play in those leagues. And ultimately that generates the great outcome for fans, but it also creates value for broadcasters. So we're doing exactly the same thing. We're trying to ensure that the very, very best players, both here and abroad, want to play and can be remunerated to play in the BBL.
I mean, largely when it comes to sports, I've always spoken about, you know, I'm a Labor guy. I'm, you know, they're the guys that put on the show. They should be remunerated. I get the feeling you put your finger in the wind and you talk to people in cricket that it feels a little bit like this current crop of modern day players, that they want their cake and they want to eat it too. They want the national contract. They want the comfort that comes from having the ACA support behind them in a way that we don't see unions in, you know, big money leagues around the world, for example, representing the players. And it's certainly guys in the SA20 aren't getting central contracts, you know, anywhere near the money that obviously our guys are getting. But then they also want the chance to be able to go out there and make money when it comes to franchise cricket as well. Do the players have a sober reality as to how much the other guys in the world are getting, and that the fact that particularly the central contracted guys, if you added all these things together, they're not actually that far apart from one another?
I think we are at a moment in time, Corb, where these sort of questions need to be answered. And I also think if you go back to my premise that there'll be a smaller number of really high quality T20, tier one, call them tier one leagues, with big remuneration opportunities for players, then they're going to have to pick and choose where they play and try to balance that out against the bilateral schedule. I mean, the ICC is doing a deep piece of work at the moment too about, can we actually have well-articulated windows for both T20 franchise leagues, ICC events, and then bilateral cricket. And that's trying to unscramble an egg. It's not easy. And we've only got 12 months of the year and 52 weeks. So players have to make distinct choices. And in a job like mine, what we have to do is make sure we give players the very best opportunity to make the choices we want them to make, because that's important for us.
Do you reckon they're fearful about public backlash, that they don't? That they also want to be seen in a position, at least publicly, that, hey, we're not turning our back on Australian cricket?
Well, I'd answer that question by saying I think the current crop of players are acutely aware of exactly what you've talked about and have a deep appreciation and love for playing for their country. The question that I have is, what's the next generation of players going to do? And will they have the same level of stickiness to play for their country and to play bilateral cricket while there are such significant financial opportunities available to the rest of the world? And what I have to do is just give myself all the ammunition possible to retain our best players and keep them in our marketplace to ensure those revenues continue to grow. And remembering that those revenues ultimately pay the rest of the playing cohort, who are the pathways and the system which creates Australian cricket's secret sauce. That's our success. So trying to keep that flywheel in motion, we may be at a difficult point in our history. So that's why these decisions feel so difficult and they're being debated.
One of the proposals put forward as a way to raising more money for the game has been gambling. And essentially Cricket Australia have said through multiple channels that they're not keen to explore that any further than they currently do. I guess the counterpoint would be, if you're in it at all, aren't you better off maximising the amount that you get out of it? Or if you don't believe in gambling, why don't you get out of it completely and essentially, you know, just rid yourself of any kind of gambling partnership?
Well, let me make a couple of comments there. First and foremost, wagering is being purposeful and deliberate in that we absolutely leave money on the table in order to make clear, considered strategic decisions at the CA board level. What I mean by that is we have deliberately decided not to put wagering into the Big Bash. That's been a clear and considered reason. Now, if we were to change that decision, we would generate significantly more money. But that's a decision that's been deliberate and purposeful. There are, though, ways for us to look at product fees, and we're doing that work. And is there more to be gained from that? There may be. It's not a material sum, but there are more opportunities available to us. The real decision, though, is that even if cricket decided that there was no wagering and no gambling, that's only part of the solution for us, because people will still bet on cricket. Venues and stadium operators will still have their level of signage and opportunity, as will our broadcast partners, who will do that it without us anyway. So effectively, what we've got to make sure of is we take what's owed to us when people are using our IP, but we use our voice and our profile wisely. And I think that's the thread of where we are on wagering as we speak. We could make significantly more money, but we understand that we have a social license in this country and legislative change is on the horizon, but we're open to the conversation, but we do have firm views on why we're protecting the sport in certain areas.
We got a heart out and appreciate you being so generous with your time, Todd. Quick one to finish. Has the BBL draft been scrapped for the imports?
No, it hasn't been scrapped as far as I'm aware, but it's, again, one of the things we're looking at deeply. I think in all the research we see, fans want to see the best Australian players, but equally, if we're going to grow the sport and we're going to grow our revenue base, we have to have the best international players continuing to visit our competition. So that's open to us on how we do that, whether that's through the form of the draft or simply as we generate more interest in the competition with other investment.
Todd, your time's always greatly appreciated. We've always got plenty of questions for you and you handle them all beautifully. So I appreciate your time jumping on and all the very best on what is a busy period, I'm sure, as the CEO of Cricket Australia.
My pleasure. I'm sure it won't be the last time we have this conversation, Corb. So we'll keep in touch, but appreciate your support of the game.